You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. I just scared our guest real quick. But we're going to welcome to this wonderful interview, Mr. Greg Koch. How are you, Greg?
I am well. How you doing?
I'm good. You just came back from a European tour. How was that?
It was very good. I'm still a little
jet lagged,
but you know what? It's not going to stop us.
That's right. And you know what? It's always worse coming back. It's never as bad when you go there, but it's always, you just get used to the whole time shift and then you come back and then it's way worse.
And then bada bing, exactly.
So where all did you play out there? I know you were in Whitney. I think you were in Whitney in England, right?
Oh, yeah. We were all over the UK. Well, we left on the evening of the 4th of September, got into Frankfurt on the morning of the 5th, drove like 5 hours after the plane landed.
Wow.
To go just north of Hamburg to do a club there. And then we just went from there. So all over Germany, we went to do the thing in the Netherlands. And then we went into, we were in Austria, went over to Switzerland. Then we were in Provence. And
where did you play in Austria?
We played in this little town that was on the Austrian-Hungarian border, pretty much. This little town. Sky is this cool club. Like Alan Holdsworth had played there, and
wow, that's awesome.
All kinds of people had played in this little joint. And it's kind of a thing where we did a workshop during the day, and then we did a gig at night. And people showed up. We had a good old time. The only problem was that Dylan, my son, was I had just gotten this new road case for this amp over there, and the road cases are a little weird. Instead of having like two latches on each side, they have one latch for each longer side. It's kind of weird. And I'd been having problems with trying to see if it was latched or not. Well, on this particular day, one of the latches wasn't latched. And as Dylan picked up the thing, the case to put it in the vehicle, the amp came out and smashed his foot and broke his toe.
Are you serious?
His foot was trashed. I mean, he could still use the hi-hat with his left foot.
Wow.
But his left foot was bad. Luckily, the guy that owned the club had like a boot, you know, like a cast type of boot type of thing, and put the thing on ice right away. But the very next day we had to drive from there all the way over to Switzerland, and that was a long drive. So we just figured it wasn't broken, you know, nothing, there was nothing they could do. So we just kept on going, and so he could still play. So we actually got home and he got an x-ray. So we'll find out if it's broke tomorrow.
Wow. And that's crazy to do that when you're on the road in another country. It's like,
exactly.
That's so fun. I actually lived in Graz, Austria for about 3 months.
Oh, nice.
So I love Austria, but that's why I was curious too, because it's, I'm like, where would you play in Austria? Like,
well, then we played in this little, there's this cool little club called Bluesiana, and it's in this place called Velden.
Okay.
Which is up in the Alps on this lake. It's gorgeous. So we did that one too. And plus we had a day off there, which did not disappoint.
And you did a day with the pedal guys. Didn't you do
Yeah. Then we went over to, well, I did, before that all happened, we went to, we did that big guitar show in Mannheim, the Guitar Summit.
That's awesome.
We did a big, we were kind of the house band for the jam on Saturday night. So we went out and did a set, and then we were bringing people up, and we had Phil X and Jared James Nichols and these Swedish metal cats. And then we had Andy Wood. It was good times. Anyways, awesome. Then from there we went to England, and then yeah, we did the pedal show, and that episode is kind of blowing up.
That's awesome.
I get a little wild on that show.
Well, it's what's so cool is like that's like if you like gear and you like pedals, that's one of the best shows to like just watch. You know, just if you don't know who's playing or what pedals they're going to showcase. It's just entertaining because I like just the dialogue between the two of them. It's just funny. But I'm sure you went in there and just like lit that whole studio on fire playing. Did you experiment with any new pedals or anything?
Well, I have this new signature pedal that has come out, and it's with this Greek company called Jam. And actually the guys from the pedal show had done a signature pedal with Jam as well, and that's their harmonic tremolo that they have called the Harmonious Monk, which is one of the pedals that's on my multi effect. So we did this multi pedal that basically has, there's a smaller version that has four pedals, and then there's the Big Daddy, which has like 10 pedals on it of all of my favorite Jam pedals. And they came up with the name, which I was impressed with. It's the Cockness Monster.
That's awesome.
So we, and the artwork on it is freaking awesome.
That's, I mean, awesome. That's amazing. So
we went on there and we talked about that. Plus I got my new Reverend signature guitar that just came out, the third iteration, which is the a Strat type guitar, and so I had that as well. So we had a festive episode. I also went on Anderton's. That episode isn't out yet, but that'll be out shortly.
That's awesome. Did you enjoy that? Is that like a leisure activity for you?
Yeah, you know, those types of things, especially depending on how long I've been on the road, the humor gets a little wild, which is, I think, what the doctor ordered for those shows.
Right. And, you know, I introduced you, you know, not on the show just now, but in my Facebook post, I said, we have one of the world's greatest living guitarists, Greg Koch, tonight.
Oh, good Lord.
So my first question is, how old were you when you knew you wanted to be a musician and when you picked up the guitar? What was that moment for you? What was that moment of zen for you?
Well, I was fascinated with guitar early on. And, you know, I was a huge Hendrix fanatic. Like when I did a report on Jimi Hendrix and I was in third grade, and I used to make these, cardboard Strats and put a little string around it and jump around. And my sister, had a sewing machine, and the pedal very much resembled a wah-wah pedal. So I would take that thing and pretend I was wah-ing out. But I didn't actually get my hands on a guitar until I was 12.
Wow.
But I was so into music. You know, my mom was a good piano player, and she taught me like the boogie-woogie pattern when I was pretty young. So I had the blues form, you know, in my brain from earliest memory, right? So. Right. When I picked up the guitar, it came pretty quick. And the whole thing was, is that me and a bunch of my buddies who, was a summer of seventh grade, and we were like, okay, you play guitar, I'll play guitar, you play bass, you play the other guitar. And then we're going to play for our eighth grade graduation party.
That's awesome.
Next May. So only me and the bass player made it, but, we had to borrow a drummer from another school. But we did that gig, and I just kept on going from there. I got into a band with guys that were like seniors in high school right after that, and I just kept gigging and playing, and right around then, it's like everything else fell by the wayside. You know, my studies, any interest in anything else other than, you know, girls and guitar and a little bit of debauchery. So I knew right then and there, much to the chagrin of my parents, I might add. But you know what? It turned out. All right.
Definitely turned out all right. And were you learning Hendrix tunes, Zeppelin? Like, I've seen you do some great covers of Zeppelin and Hendrix as well.
Yeah, yeah. Early on, I would, you know, my dad was, he had been scorned by my previous musical exploits. I tried to play the cello. I really wanted to play guitar, but the guitar wasn't available. So in third grade, I played the cello. And I remember trying to figure out how to play Easy Rider by Jimi Hendrix on the cello. It was not effective. And so my interest in that kind of fell by the wayside. So my dad was scorned by, you know, the rental and the books and the rosin and what have you. And then a couple of years later, there was, it went from orchestra to band. And then I played snare drum and bell kit and band. And I was less than, you know, studious with that as well. So when I wanted to play guitar, he was not feeling it. So he's like, listen, I've got this client of mine who's a guitar player. He plays guitar, bass, banjo. You're going to take lessons from him. And the moment he tells me that you're not prepared for a lesson, this all ends, right?
Wow.
So I went in and I took lessons from this guy. And we worked out of the Mel Bay book, which is kind of funny because I would go on to co-write the Hal Leonard guitar method. But I actually learned from my first book was the Mel Bay book. And I within about, I don't know, 4 or 5 months, that guy came back to my old man. He said, I can't teach him anything anymore. He knows, because the guy wasn't a guitar player. You know, he played guitar, but that wasn't his main instrument. So after a few months, I had kind of surpassed his skill set, and it was time for another victim.
Well, that must have been like, you know, like a confidence booster that you were like, I'm going to these guitar teachers like it's nothing.
Well, yeah, I was a little cocky punk. I mean, I learned fast, you know, and then I took lessons from a guy who I'm still buddies with to this day. And he was into Hendrix, and he was into, I mean, he had studied jazz. He's probably like 7 years older than me at the time, and still is. And but he has his fundamental. He was a huge Clapton fan, which was great because I was a huge Cream era Clapton fan,
yeah, too.
And he was into, you know, Santana and Hendrix. And a lot of times I'd go in and I would just tell him to play songs so I could watch him do it, because, you know, I was back in the day where, you know, there were no instructional videos. There was no way to even watch these people play. And the video thing hadn't, you know, MTV hadn't even started yet. So it was all very much an oral tradition. Either you saw someone do it or you went and saw the concert, and then you hope for the best, or you just sat by the record player.
Oh, you were doing the Duane Allman thing where you were just using your toe to move the record.
That's correct. I live by the record player. And, you know, and I never slowed them down either. I mean, oh, some people were on top of that and slowing them down, but I never did that. I just struggled away at, you know, at the original tempo, trying to figure out what the hell was going on with these records. But the thing was that I would put the, you know, my mom would be cooking dinner and I'd put the timer on for an hour. And then I'd sit in the other room so she could hear me playing all the things from the book that I was supposed to be learning, so that she could report back to my dad that I was, in fact, doing my homework. And then as soon as that was done, I'd be up in my room at the record player, you know, trying to figure out this, that, and the next thing.
And what records would you put? Zeppelin, Hendrix?
Early on, it was, you know, I really loved Led Zeppelin 1. And then I had Fresh Cream, Jeff Beck, Truth. Of course, nice. All the Hendrix stuff.
Yeah.
Live Cream Volume 2 I got first before I got Volume 1.
Disraeli Gears? I'm kind of shocked by that.
What's that now?
No Disraeli Gears? Like, that's one of the...
Well, I didn't get Disraeli Gears until later. My brother had... He you know, it was kind of predicated on what my brother had in his collection. Right. But I remember, like, freshman year in high school, I went to... there was this cool, you know, head shop, Record Head, and they sold amongst, you know, the contraband for cannabis consumption, used records, and really... I mean, there was guitars aplenty there. I mean, it was a... If we would have walked into that place right now, back in, you know, at a time machine, it'd be like Vintage Central, and we'd be like, what's the big deal? They're just used guitars. But I remember I got a copy of Fresh Cream, and I got a copy of Truth by Jeff Beck. And then one summer, I just went back and forth. That and Hendrix in the West. I'd listen to Hendrix in the West, and then I'd hyper-focus on that, and then I'd go to Fresh Cream. And then I go to, it was one of those things where, you know, I can't remember if my brother had, yeah, he had moved out by then and taken most of his records.
Right.
So I had kind of a limited thing, and you would just learn from the records you had. You know what I mean?
Yep.
And, but I did, I was very much aware of the fact that the blues influenced these guys that I was into. And I was very much into figuring out where these sounds were coming from. So there was a radio show that was on in the evenings, like at 10:30 at night, and I would stay up with my little cassette player, and once a week they would have this thing called Portraits in Blue, which they would take a particular blues artist, and it was a syndicated program, and they would do, you know, Howlin' Wolf or T-Bone Walker, Little Walter, Albert King, and I would tape these on a cassette, and I would just listen back and wow, try to play this stuff. And B.B. King Live at the Regal was another one.
That is one of my favorite records of all time.
Yes, absolutely. And then all the John Mayall stuff. You know, I had, you know, the, of course, the Beano, you know, Blues Breakers record with Clapton. I just slaved over.
Right.
And then there were all these other Mutation records that had, you know, there was a record called Looking Back, which kind of had all of them on it. So It was, you know, Clapton was on there, Peter Green, Mick Taylor, the gang,
all the heavies. Yeah.
Yes. And, so I, and then I saw the Allman Brothers when I was a freshman, at Summerfest in Milwaukee. And,
Not with Dwayne.
This would have been with Danny Toler and Dickie Betts, and you know, it was that iteration.
But you still saw him with Chuck Lavelle. You had to see him with Chuck Lavelle then.
No, Chuck wasn't with him then. It was that iteration from like 78 through 81, right?
Eat a Peach, I think, right?
Well, this was that Enlightened Rogues record came out in 78. It was like their big comeback record, except it wasn't quite the big comeback. And then they had two records that were attempting kind of pop stuff because they were on Arista and Clive Davis was trying to
change
make pop stars out of the Allman Brothers. And that didn't quite take, but right. Live, they were awesome. And I saw that show and it blew my mind. And I remember I went home and I dug through my sister's records because I knew I saw some Allman Brothers in there, and I found Live at the Fillmore, and that changed everything.
That's one of the best records ever. Probably exactly. One of the best live records ever made.
Absolutely. Still,
and I love that you said that you love the Allman Brothers because they're like one of my favorite bands of all time. I think they've been one of my biggest influences as far as like how to make arrangements sound great, because they would just build dynamics and just like know how to like play lengthy solos and make it interesting, not meandering.
Right.
And I know you know what I'm talking about because
I know
so many jam bands that will just meander, and then it's just like, man, this is going on too long.
Right.
But they
there was definitely there was intention in a different way with the Allman Brothers when they would improvise.
And did that influence like what gear you were getting, because they were playing Les Pauls, or did you just kind of like start steering your way into creating your own sound even back then?
Well, the thing was that I had that second guitar teacher I had, he had a Telecaster for sale, and I ended up buying this Telecaster, and it wasn't because all my favorite guitar players up to that point were Telecaster players. They weren't, none of them were. I mean, I knew that, a Tele was on, I don't even think I knew that Jimmy Page played a Tele on the first record.
Right.
All I knew is that I wanted the neck pickup sound on a Fender guitar, because the guitar I had before that was a Fender Lead One, which in the late 70s, early 80s, Fender had like, they were kind of like student line guitars, and the Lead One just had a humbucker in back,
okay,
in the bridge position and no neck position. So, and I was I loved the sound of when Hendrix would play blues clean on that neck pickup. I was like, I gotta have it. And so I bought that guitar from that teacher of mine, and that became the Tele just kind of became my template, and it would kind of come and go. And then later on, it became more of my main thing. But the reason why it was always it was my formative guitar, and it kind of had everything on it as far as like, you know, you're on the neck pickup, you're building the solo, you go to the bridge pickup, you go for the jugular, you know, and then the middle position, it's a great rhythm sound or a chunkier lead sound. And it's just like, there's three sounds, they're all great. And it's just kind of up to you and your hands to just take this kind of blank canvas and annihilate.
I have a Fender Esquire, I think a 64, like a reissue Fender Esquire.
Yeah.
It's exactly that. It's like, it's a one trick pony, but it's like the best trick, one trick pony.
Yeah, totally.
Getting the guitar. So I love that. And did you kind of just like figure right away, it just spoke to you, this is the sound, this is the, and it's also like, I know for me, it's like sometimes the weight distribution on a guitar just feels a certain way. Like I love the way a Tele feels versus Strat. I love a Strat too.
It was weird. I mean, I tell the story about how, you know, knowing my age at that point in time was into the music I was into. I thought I was onto something that no one else was onto, because and of course I'm in this microcosm. I don't know what's going on in the world. Right. All I know is what's going on in my little kingdom of wrongdoing. And everybody that was my age that was into music, they were either into, you know, just, you know, popular drivel, or if they were into music, they were into Rush, you know, and I didn't grow up listening to, or they were into Van Halen, right? And I wasn't into that. I was into this bluesy rootsy oriented stuff. And then once I heard Albert King and knew how that affected Hendrix's playing and so on and so forth, I was like, man, I'm going to combine this Hendrix thing with this bluesy thing and a little bit of this country thing and throw it all together. And that's going to be my jam. I'm going to come out the gates and I'm going to annihilate. And then junior year, and with the Fender style guitar, because no one was using a clean sounding Fender at the time. It was, that just wasn't the thing, other than like Mark Knopfler. But anywho, so also I'm listening to the radio one day and this tune comes on. It's David Bowie and there's this guy doing Albert King licks. I'm like, what?
Stevie Ray Vaughan, baby.
I say, what? What is this?
Yes.
Who's doing that? And then I went and got his record and listened to that. And I was just like, everything I thought I had like the inside scoop on.
You're like, this guy's been doing this too.
he just took and annihilated.
So now, did you ever get to see him live?
I did. I saw him three times.
Wow. Where? Where?
I saw him at Summerfest twice. Actually, maybe I only saw him twice. I had tickets to go see him with Jeff Beck. And then I had a gig that night, so I couldn't go.
Oh, my God. That's crazy.
And then the Saturday night of before the day he died, I had tickets to go see him. And I had another gig, so I didn't go.
Wow.
And then my girlfriend at the time, now my wife, and I were going to go to the Sunday night show. But Alpine Valley was about 40 minutes away. And Bonnie Raitt was in town, and she was right down the street. I was like, let's go see Bonnie. Plus it was rumored that that Stevie Ray might fly up and sit in with her.
Wow.
So we went to the show, and then of course the next day we found out what happened. But I saw him a few times.
What did you think? That must have been a mind-blowing experience, because you being into the same players and the same kind of style of phrasing and soloing and blues, you know, like just massive blues explosion guitar playing.
Right.
What was the experience that you felt when you heard him play?
Well,
his tone and all that.
You know, when the first record came out, I just was like, this is fantastic. This is everything I was kind of aiming for. And then the second record came out, and I love Scuttlebutt, but when he did the Hendrix tune, for whatever reason, it really rubbed me the wrong way. And I don't know. I'm trying to remember why. But I remember that's the same reason at the time why I lost respect for Robin Trower as well. It's like, get your own thing, man. You know what I mean? It's like, don't, you know, and for some reason it just rubbed me the wrong way, which seems weird in retrospect. But at the time, that's how I felt. And I remember when I finally saw Stevie, I had the same reaction both times. It's like after I heard like three songs, I was like, I've heard every note he's going to play for the entire night. And I actually left the first one after about four tunes because Greg Allman's band was playing, and I liked the song. I liked his tunes better. And so it was a weird thing. I was a super fan and really respected what he did, but it's almost like as a survival instinct, I was like, I got to do something different. Because this guy has absolutely, you know, annihilated this particular.
What's interesting thing. Too is like, I think all guitar players have this competitive nature. Like, it's just, there's this thing where it's like, oh my God, if you see somebody that's doing something similar, you're like, I can't listen to this because I need to, you know, find my own lane and just do my own thing.
Yeah, it was a bit of that. Yeah,
I can see that. I could totally see that.
And then right after that, I eschewed the Fender guitar for a Gibson because I was now my thing was the neck pickup sound, that fat, juicy, succulent sound of a neck pickup on a 335 or a Les Paul.
Right.
That's going to be my thing now. So then I went down that rabbit hole for a while, and then I would go back to Tellys and Strats. But I'm kind of glad I went through all those different weird, you know, really obsessive hyper-focus tangents.
I love that too. That's how you find your sound. I mean,
exactly.
You go through all these rites of passage of like what you're, you know, playing on. Now, what were you using amp wise? Were you doing Marshall half stacks? Were you doing Fender twins? Like, what were you using?
Well, funny enough, you know, I didn't really have any friends, or even the older guys around me weren't like gearheads, right? So no one was really steering me like, oh, you should use this. And you I did get a Fender Twin early on, but it was a master volume twin, and it had Altec Lansing speakers in it. So it was loud and clean, and I couldn't get it to overdrive. So I remember I traded it, and plus it was breaking down. For whatever reason, it was kind of a lemon, and it kept on blowing up. And this buddy of mine had this solid-state half-stack thing that had Celestians in a 412 cabinet, but it sounded good. Wow. You know, you could turn it out. It was called, it was a VT, and I think they were made in Canada. And so I used that amp for a minute, but I still remember hearing cassette copies. It sounded fantastic. Right. And then a little while after that, the Yamaha G100 212 amp came out. And I remember this guy at this music store who was an older dude. He was telling me, look, this amp is, you know, you don't have to worry about tubes and da-da-da-da-da-da-da. And I was like, okay, you know what I mean? And so I used that amp, but still I have recordings of that. And that sounded good.
Right.
But it wasn't until, you know, I was later in my, you know, this all of this stuff is happening in the course of like months. You know what I mean? It's like back in the day, it seemed like it was this saga. You know what I mean? Right. But we're talking about ages, you know, 14 to 18 here, you know?
Right.
And then I got a Music Man RD-112, and which, of course, it's a tube amp, but with a solid-state preamp. And that was my main amp through college.
And you were able to move some air with that amp a little bit. So there's, because like solid-state amps can be a little bit compressed, and it's just, they sound good, but when you have like a real, you know, tube amp, there's...
Plus it had a JBL in it. It had a JBL 12 in it. And so it was loud. And then somewhere after that amp got stolen along with my 335. And then I got another one, but it didn't have a JBL. It didn't quite sound as good. And then I ended up getting a Jim Kelly amp, which a buddy of mine had recommended. He's like, if you ever see a Jim Kelly amp, just buy it without even hearing it. And he was right. I bought it, and it was amazing. And so that really, you know, was like crash course and tube amp habit. Because that was like, you know, he's kind of, Jim Kelly was kind of like a Dumble-esque character back in the day.
Yes.
And
were you using any pedals? Were you doing like any kind of Klon Centaur?
Back then I was a knob. I was like, it's got to be, you know, right into the amp type of guy.
That's awesome.
That's awesome. I didn't discover tube screamers until a little later. Into a super reverb. Then I went through the whole super reverb thing, and I had a million super reverb. Well, not a million, but more than one. Let's put it that way.
Right.
I would get one, I'd sell one, I'd get one, I'd sell one. And I went through a few of them. So a super reverb was my main amp after that for a long time. Fender Bassmans, stuff like that.
I love that because that, you know, kind of distinguishes you, how you got to your sound now. And before we go on, I want to play one of your studio tracks first, because this is one of my favorite songs you guys have ever written with the Cock Marshall Trio.
Yes.
And let's play. We're going to play Daddy Long Legs.
Here's
Daddy
Long Legs
by the Cock Marshall Trio.
Along in the up there, Daddy Long Legs. Daddy Long Legs. We're cruising along in the up there, Daddy Long Legs. You headed up the cripple with your chromed beard. You're looking kind of scary. It's Daddy Long Legs. It's cruising along in the up now, Daddy Long Legs.
She's bringing the heat,
Daddy Long Legs. It's cruising along in the up now, Daddy Long Legs. He don't have no web or a killer bite. He just creeps alone, Daddy Long. long legs. And cruising along in the up now. Daddy long legs.
Funny, I described the Cock Marshall Trio as if you took Modesty Martin and Wood and Jeff Beck was in the band and you sprinkled a whole can of whoop ass, that's the Cock Marshall Trio. It's true. You got so many cool influences, but you have your own sound with a lot of this. I hear a lot of Jeff Beck, Scofield in your playing. I hear Jimmy Page. I hear David Gilmour, but I hear a lot of you in how,
oh, thank you,
create, how you play. There's things I've seen you do with a volume knob alone. You have that one tune where you're doing the volume knob on
everything. Oh, yeah. Tonus Diabolicus.
Just crazy. It's just craziness. So let me ask you, what inspires you as a guitar player? Is it writing? Is it licks? Is it riffs? Is it all of it? How it all comes together? What is it for you as a guitar player and a musician?
You know what? It fluctuates. And I think that's why it's always interesting to me. So I mean, when I knew I was going to do this interview, I just came out here and I just went on iTunes and just started playing along with songs, you know. Yeah. But earlier today I had I dug out this Ted Green book, and I remember I had that chord chemistry book, and initially I was just like, well, the front part of the book is just all these different inversions,
right?
Of all these different chords. I'm like, oh, that's cool. You know, here's a cool version. Here's a good, cool inversion. But then I looked in the back, and then he has these like circular 5-1, 5-1 thing that keeps on fluctuating into different keys. And it sounds awesome. And that just like totally inspired me. It's like I kind of instinctively do those kinds of cadences anyway, but just the way that he explained it and in the way that he did it, like it's been melding my mind for the last couple of days. So now I'm kind of, and typically what will happen is when I get a new idea like that, I'll end up writing a tune. So I'm in the process of sussing out a tune using that stuff. But, you know, with playing so much on the road, man, it just, you know, we're just as a band, as a unit, we're firing on all cylinders. And then improvising wise, you know, it's just effortless to kind of just fall into the groove. And I'm really into, you know, this kind of idea of sequential playing, or it's call and response ish, but what you're about to play is influenced by what you just played. That right. way you never play the same thing even remotely twice. And it's not lick based either. I mean, there might be licks that are part of that conversation that you're having with yourself, really, or with right. the universe, or whatever you want to call it. But there's other times where you're just going off, and you're like riding a tightrope, and that makes it fun from a musician point of view playing it, but it's also fun for the crowd, because you can tell that when you're on that, when all that magic stuff starts happening, where you're not really in control, and there, it's just like kind of on all autopilot, people can sense that thing, and man, right. the whole room starts to get the heebie-jeebies, and that's what I live for, doggone it.
I just did a session with Bruce Hornsby's keyboardist, and he said the coolest thing. He said, every time I want to just like grab on the musical vibe that I want to, it disappears. And he's like, the moment I just like allow something to kind of like manifest and just like not pay attention, that's when the most musical stuff happens.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you, as a player, I mean, I've heard you just shred for hours and hours and hours. Do you ever surprise yourself when you're in the middle of a solo with something that you played that you're like, I got to remember that because that was so hip going to that thing? There must be moments like that for you as a player.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that we'll play and I'll remember that some weird stuff happened, that I'll be like, yeah, there were some moments there where we just kind of went for stuff and I don't really recall what happened. And then inevitably someone will post a video. And I'll be like, oh, that's what happened. And I'll be like, well, that's because you just realize that you do things in the moment that are, again, they're not licks. They're things that are just coming at that point in time. And you reach for stuff. And sometimes you're just like, I think this could work. And thank God, more often than not, it does. But it's just kind of, it's not stabbing in the dark, because, you know, you've been playing forever. So you know what's going to sound good, hopefully, but there are moments where it's just random stuff that kind of comes together. And those magic moments, sometimes I will go back and say, I'm going to remember that one. But other times I'll have to see it or hear it from somebody posting something online and be like, man, that's
a cool idea. I should elaborate on that.
You know? Yes, exactly. Yes.
And you know what? So like we kind of talked about you starting bands early on. Did you ever go through a phase where you were like the session guitarist and you were just doing sessions constantly? Or were you always like, I want to be in a band. This is where I want to thrive. This is what I want to do.
I did a fair bit of sessions. I started getting hired locally to do commercials and jingles and people's records and stuff. And I enjoyed it. But when I started doing some sessions down in Chicago, that was a lot of fun. And that was wild, because I did a Fender clinic down in Chicago at this.
Watch out for that mic.
Yeah. And, I did this, my first Fender clinic down at Gann Music in Chicago. And at the end of the night, Gary Gann came up to me and said, hey, do you do session work at all? I go, well, yeah. I mean, when people ask me, I do it. And he's like, well, you know, there's a lot of session work down in Chicago. I'm like, yeah, I've heard tell.
Right.
And he said, well, you know, a buddy of mine has this jingle house. He does a lot of work. I'm going to tell him about you. I'm like, okay, cool. So, you know, people say that kind of stuff all the time. And, you know, a lot of times you never hear anything. Well, 2 days later, I get a call. Hey, this is, you know, Terry Fryer Music and, you know, Gary Gann, yada, yada, yada. Are you available for a session tomorrow? I'm like, yes. And I remember that first session. It was for a Bank America commercial. And I walked in and I'm terrified, right? Because I had heard the entire time I was in college that people who do sessions in Chicago are such good sight readers that when they run through a song, they're not running it through to make sure that they can play it. They're running through it to make sure the notes on the page are correct.
Wow.
Those are the kind of things you heard in college, right? I'm terrified. So I go in to do the session, and I know one of the other guitar players. He's playing lap steel and some other different things on the side. He's like, "Hey, what's going on?" I was like, "Hey, what's happening?" He's like, "Do you know who's all in this room?" I'm like, "Don't tell me. I don't want to know." So it was one of these things where he had this big budget to do this commercial. And he hired like all the top session guitar players in town, or a good chunk of them. Bunch of guys that had played on like a bunch of this, you know, that Cadet Records, you know, it was a subsidiary of Chess and all this, these Soul Records and whatnot. They were there. This buddy of mine who played, you know, was kind of a lap steel, you know, mandolin type of guy. And then Howard Levy was there.
Wow.
Playing harp and playing mandolin. And then some other, it was like, dude, it was insane, right? And I remember we did the first track. They brought out the first, there were three different tracks we were doing. Bring the first one out. And okay, it goes like this. I right away, I'm scanning the chart for the single note lines because I can read chord charts like, you know, right, in my sleep. But the single note lines, I got to woodshed them because I can't read them as they come, right? So I'm like, oh, okay. I made sure I kind of had a grasp on that, but I didn't have to do it because the other instruments were doing the melodic stuff. I just come up with a cool part. So I come up with a part. We record the first one. We get done. Everyone's looking around going, awesome, one down. I'm like, fantastic. This is going well. And then the very next one, we start running through it, and I came up with this little part, and we're doing it, and we run through it once, and then the producer comes in the room. He's like, "Hey, I want you to double the melody with Howard." And he points to me, so I have to do a dual melody with Howard Levy.
Wow,
terrified. So now I'm looking at the chart, going, "Okay." I mean, it wasn't, it's not like it was rocket science, but it, you know, but it was,
oh,
it was
still, it's in the moment. The sirening thing is another
exactly
level of nerves. Yes, absolutely.
So luckily, by the time the producer went around and made comments to other people, I had learned the part and I had it. So he went in the other room. They did the next track. Howard and I locked in, did it. And I just remember him looking over and giving me a nod. I'm like,
oh. You're like, I made it. That's it. The nod from Howard Levy.
And then we did the third one, and it went great. It was like all well and done. But at the time, you're so stressed out and freaking out. Did that go well? Was it good? And then I remember I'm just driving back to Milwaukee from Chicago, just going, oh, I hope that was good. And then the very next day, I got called to do another one. Wow. And then that one was an Oldsmobile commercial. And it was literally like Kungas and electric guitar.
Wow.
And so that was my first big national TV commercial, where I remember shortly thereafterward, we were up visiting the in-laws. And of course they're like, oh my God, my daughter's married this guitar player who probably will never be able to make any money whatsoever. And I remember we were up there and we were watching TV and that commercial came on.
You're like, that's me. That's
and
me.
I go, I played on that. And that was one of those moments where they're like, interesting, maybe he's not such a putz after all.
Well, I think for every guitar player listening, you just, they're all sighing relief because they know that you got nervous for a session, because anybody hears you play and they're like, there's no way this guy ever gets nervous about a session, about any guitar part. Well, let's play a video that we're going to play. The Cock Marshall Trio playing Heed the Boogaloo.
Oh, it's an old one. Oh, an oldie but a goodie.
Oldie but goodie. Here we go.
Thank you.
God damn.
Bing, I mean, bang, boom.
You know what's cool? It's like your goatee was in its infancy stage in that video. But, dude, that solo, I mean, that's one of the reasons I wanted to play that video. That solo is insane.
Oh,
it's
thank
so
you.
Oh, good. It's just, you know, and I'm going to give you a huge compliment. Like, you know, my two favorite Jeff Beck records are Wired and Blow by Blow.
Oh, yeah.
So much of your phrasing sounds like if those two, like, albums had a birth child, your solos would be that birth child. It's the new dimension of it, and you take it somewhere else. And my next question is, I know Jeff Beck and some of these older players were huge influences on you, but I also hear a tremendous amount of jazz influence in what you're playing. How much of that do you kind of like integrate? Are you listening to, because you're taking the blues to another place, and I'm sure you know this. And if you don't, you should. And it's what people need to hear, because it's like such a cool hybrid of all the stuff that was before, but all the stuff that's happening now in a totally new way. So how much is that kind of influencing what you're playing, how you're playing?
Well, I do, you know, jazz was a weird thing for me because I was so... And again, this is on me, as my wife would say, that's on you. There were so many jazz educators that rubbed me the wrong way early on.
Right.
That, it, you know, because if you were a guitar player in jazz academia throughout high school and once I got to college, luckily the guitar guy was totally cool and open to what I was doing. But there was a lot of this, you know, if you bent a string, you were a heretic. And there was a lot of this attitude of, if you were into, you know, it didn't matter if you were into ABBA or if you were into Yes, it was just that rock crap to them.
Right.
That's just that rock crap. You're like, there's a huge gap there between ABBA and Yes, but okay. And so
with classical music, because that's how classical music was. It's like,
and that's how, yeah, classical music did that to the jazz guys.
Yeah.
And then, but yet the jazz guys had to pass that down to the rock and roller. So, but not all of them, you know, just it's, you know, it's not all the people that do that. But in my experience, it was enough of them that it really turned me off to the music. So there were aspects of, there were bluesier guys that I liked that used some jazz influence, and I was interested in that. It wasn't until years later that I actually just enjoyed listening to jazz,
right,
and kind of doing more of a deep dive. So, you know, I'm not someone that knows like 50 standards backwards and forwards. I know a few standards. Every now and again, I'll learn a new one. But it's not, and most of them are very bluesy. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like, you know,
right.
Roundabout Midnight, you know, Goodbye Pork Pie Hat. Stuff like, you know, Killer Joe, you know, those types of things, you know, and Sugar and, you know, those types of songs. But I definitely, you know, understood the harmony and I went to school for music so that I would understand how to play over chord changes and be able to read and write music at somewhat a professional level. And I got that. A lot of the more advanced harmony of playing over changes, even though it was taught to me in school, I didn't actually apply it in any way that really made sense to me until the years went on. And that still happens. I mean, I, you know, every now and again, I'll the internet will have a chestnut where some guy goes, "Have you heard this scale?" And usually I'm like, I turn off, but this one the other day, I was like, "Oh, that's cool." And then, "Oh, you can use this in order to play over a 2-5-1. I was like, "Well, that's cool." So I'm my ears are always open to that stuff to try to add a little bit more
soft
to the toolbox.
Well, what's cool is, like, you know, sometimes jazz can take it to a place where it's like, all right, it's just so out that it's like, right, it becomes not enjoyable. Like, it's like, okay, this is cool, I like where you're taking it, but it's like where you take it is so hip because it's like you'll hint at it going out, but it's so in the pocket with groove and like blues and rock and those kind of being the major pillars that it just goes out enough that you're right back in. And that's really not easy to do, because it's so easy to, like, once you start exploring going out,
you never go back in.
You know, so the fact that you're able to just, like, kind of maneuver that, I've always kind of, like, been in awe of that whenever you play, because you just really have this firm grasp on, like, your sound and your voice, and it integrates it just enough, but not where it's like, oh, you're going to lose half your audience because now you're going to a place where you're exploring and nobody is following you.
As far as speed and stuff is concerned too. I mean, I've really tried to hone that over the years to the point where, you know, if you bombard people from beginning to end of the solo with fiery stuff, it loses its efficacy. The same thing with any kind of outside stuff. So I like to use as you said, the pillars of the stuff is the bluesy, greasy articulation and phrasing and so on and so forth. And then when you throw in a little outside thing or a little speedy salvo, it's way more effective.
Right.
And so that's what I try to do anyway. So,
well, I'm sure, you know, you've definitely shared the stage. We share the stage at Summerfest and we open for ZZ Top. I'm sure you have intimidated some of your favorite guitar players, but have there ever been moments where you're like, man, this is just cool. I'm jamming with so-and-so. And who was that player for you?
Oh, well, getting to be buddies with the guys in Little Feet and sitting in with them all the time was definitely one of my highest points.
Best bands.
Yeah, it was one of my favorite bands of all time. And just to be able to play with them and be buddies with them and have them respect, you know, it was just awesome. So that's probably my all-time favorite thing. Although, you know, when I sat in with Lonnie Mack, that was awesome, you know. Wow. And he was like, you know, his wife would always tell me, he refers to you as the guitar player from hell. You know, and then, you know, I didn't get to jam with them, but, you know, we did a show with Danny Gatton and he said some really nice stuff. Jeff Beck said some really nice stuff after he saw us play.
Incredible.
So, I mean, those types of the things are the things that I remember. But, you know, jamming with James Burton was awesome at his guitar festival. That was a big one. Jamming with Albert Lee that was awesome. So there's various different things over the years that kind of come to mind, but there's been, you know, you just kind of forget them all. I mean, that's not to sound weird, but, you know, it's like I had to rattle my brain, like, because, you know, they happen, they're so monumental in the moment, but then you're just on to the next thing.
Well, and it's also like your vehicle is the Cock Marshall Trio, and it's like that's the unit that is, you know, kind of like going through the journey. And like when all these other people, when you have those moments, it's great, but it's like, you know, the evolution and the journey is about this musical project kind of getting to people's ears. You know what I mean?
Absolutely.
So that's like the one thing that you have to, you know, think about. I want to play one of the last tracks. We're going to play Unrepentant. This is Cock Marshall Trio with Unrepentant.
We'll be right back.
so killing. It's ridiculous. It's so ridiculous. I want to say, Greg, on behalf of all guitar players, thank you for being such a gift to the instrument.
Like, oh,
you are pushing it forward. Kind. If people aren't telling you enough, they should be, because you are pushing the instrument forward in such a tremendous way. I've told you this before. You're the reason I bought my Silver Sky, because of your conversation with Paul Reed Smith. Because,
oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's like, you just, when you play the instrument, it is truly something special. And I feel like lucky to know you, but also really lucky to hear you play, because it is such a tremendous gift that you give to all of us. And I hope you never stop. Hope you never stop touring. You're always welcome back on Wake Up Hollywood. Thank you so much for being a guest on Wake Up Hollywood.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
My last question is, where can people find you if they want to find you online, if they want to find your music, if they want to find where you're playing next? Where can we find Greg Koch and the Koch Marshall Trio?
Well, the easiest thing is just go to gregkoch.com. That's where all the stuff as far as the music and all the merch and the tour dates and so on and so forth, it's all in there. But I'm very active on Instagram, Greg Koch Music. Go to my YouTube page, which is also Greg Koch Music. And coincidentally enough, also on Facebook at Greg Koch Music. And I'm on Twitter at Mansquatch. That was a mistake. But it's hard for people to find me on there, but whatever. But yeah, those are the places I'm pretty active on I try to put entertaining stuff up on the social medias for the kids. And what's fun is when we're out and touring, I'll do little pre-gig announcements of where we're playing, usually from the tour vehicle or whatnot. And they're usually,
I watch them all. They're hilarious, dude. They're so good. And you know what? It's like, it's not just like the typical, hey, we're playing here. You have a very funny sense of humor, and like the way you kind of like promote your shows, it's like a page that every musician should learn from, because it's funny. It's like you have a really, I saw you in the van eating your chocolate, the Cadbury chocolate.
Exactly.
It's like you know exactly how to promote it in a way that's fun and funny.
Well, thank you.
Much like your music, it's always fun. It's always great. So I can't wait to you tour again.
And well, we're gonna be out in your neck of the woods for NAMM. We got a bunch of the Cadillac Zach gigs, and I think we're doing a Venice West again too. So
awesome. Do you know the dates offhand or no?
That NAMM weekend.
Okay. All right. So end of January, basically.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. Awesome. Well, on behalf of Greg, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Peace, love, and take care of yourselves. Take care of each other. We out.
Woo!
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence. Right here on LA Talk Radio.